You're outside the socket, making no contact to it. But you hold this device near the narrow blade, it will light. You hold it near the broad blade, it'll go out. You hold it near the green, the round pin, it'll go out, if you know what I mean. So it is using the capacitive coupling to the universe of your body and your hand holding onto this device. And if it sees something close to 110 volts at the tip with reference to you, it'll light up. So that's a very handy device. Let me drop. Now, one of the things to check on once every couple of years is to make sure that the piece of, I think it's 8-gauge or 6-gauge wire coming from your local pole pick transformer down that utility pole, usually it's under a round piece of wood, and is that wire complete all the way down to the butt plate, the copper plate at the bottom of the utility pole? Is that wire properly installed? Sometimes somebody comes along and steals the wire, or sometimes not properly rewired. And under those situations, if your pole pick transformer is not being properly grounded right at the utility pole, although the grounding in your house makes everything seem to be all right, the situation can come along where you decide that the main water cutoff valve coming into your house is now leaking, that when you turn it off, water still leaks through it, and you want to replace that valve, and you hire a plumber to replace that valve where the copper pipe comes into your house, the main cutoff valve. Let me drop. And by various means, he manages to unsolder, and doing that with water present is a hell of a problem. There's various ways that he can eventually separate the pipe from the outside versus the pipe on the inside that goes across that cutoff valve. And he's about to separate those two pipes. His left hand is on one, his right hand is on the other. At the instant they disconnect, tremendous amounts of voltage from that floating system from the 13 kilovolts outside can appear across him, and he'll die. A smart guy will put a clamp-on ammeter across that pipe first to see if there's any current flowing. Second of all, to be double darn sure, he'll take two extremely big clip leads like you use for a battery jumping and put them across those pipes before he separates them. Go one step further than that, maybe he's got a good-sized dry rag in his hand that's wrapped around one of those pipes so that there's no way that he's in contact with the two pipes that are about to be separated, because some ridiculous voltage can appear across it if the grounding of your power wiring from your pole pick transformer to your house was not properly grounded at the utility pole. In my particular neighborhood, I have found two of those situations. So it's not quite as rare as you would think. That's something to worry about. Look what you got us into here, Rich, tonight. WB2GXM for any further questions, fills, or whatever. You brought up a darn good subject. You got it, Rich. K2IW and the TechNet.
No comment.
Yeah, stand by, Rich. Let's see what John's got to say on all of the above.
Yeah, if you watch any competent plumber, when they work on that copper pipe, they will run a cord or a metal wire, a pretty heavy gauge, usually like number two, from the copper pipe to a fire hydrant. This way they know there's going to be no voltage on that. And then also they do put that jumper to the cold water system, because there could be unbalanced current coming back that has to be transported. So if you watch them carefully, they're usually very good about that. KC2WGP, back to you, Dick.
Back on that.
Go ahead, Ed.
Very comment.
Okay, we got at least two sign-ins. Ed is one of those. K2GJE, go ahead with your comment, Ed, and then we'll pick up the other one next.
Hey, Rich. There are two places where electricians seem to pick up the water pipe ground. Sometimes they pick it up on the copper coming right into the house. Some they seem to pick it up past the first valve and even past the water meter. And it's quite common lately. They've been changing out. I don't know what electricians people or plumbers they're hiring. I have yet to see someone come into my house with a heavy jumper cable, and I've had my water down about three times. The thing to do is, in your own house, if the ground is picked up after the main valve and picked up after the water meter. All of that should be bonded. It should be bonded. So one of these plumbers, when they come in, disconnects the main valve, water meter, they're not going to get killed. There is a way that they can turn off. One way, some houses are built with what they call a curve box, where they have a wrench and they can go cut off the water coming into your house. They do have a device that clips onto the pipe and freezes it. That's another way that they cut off the water if they have to change a main valve. Over.
Jack, thank you, Ed. By putting a freezing plug on the pipe, by clamping something around the pipe and freezing it, freeze the water in it, and then drain the water out of some kind of a drip hole that's downrange, you can't do any soldering on a pipe that's got water inside. You've got to get rid of all the water first, because it's one hell of a heat sink. The biggest soldering iron in the world is not going to take that apart. There was another person that wanted to make a comment. Who was that? H-R-I-W-TechNet. Please give us your call letters and your name.
This is KC2QFJ, Steven. I'm on Echolink. Are you copying?
KC2QFJ, Steven, we're copying you very well, so please proceed, Steven.
Thank you. I'm mobile right now. I've been listening, and I just wanted to clarify something regarding the ground fault circuit operation. As I understand it, I can't verify it since I can't look anything up as I'm driving, but the GFCI operates by sensing the current imbalance between the hot and the neutral, not by sensing any current flowing on the ground pin. So if everything's working correctly, all the current going into the hot connector should go out the neutral. If it doesn't, that means it might be flowing through you to ground at your feet, and it's not likely to be going back to the ground pin of the device. So if there's basically a little comparator or op-amp, something, circuit and current sensing structures, any imbalance between the current coming in through the hot and the current going out through the neutral will trip the circuit breaker, so trip the GFCI. We sometimes had problems with heavy inductive loads tripping the GFCI because of their inrush of current. I'm pretty sure that's how their work. So the ground shouldn't be necessary for them to operate, but the ground on the GFCI device is always important to allow the circuit breaker to trip if there's a fault between the hot and the chassis of the device. Back to you.
ED2HUC with a comment.
Okay, you started talking before the machine picked you up. I heard 2HUC. Give me the prefix and your name and then proceed.
Hey, ED2HUC, name is Steve. You put two things on those prior comments. One, there's not an inspector in the world that would test a service entrance where the grounding electrode conductor wasn't terminated on the point of entrance of the pipe. As far as I know, there's no inspector that would allow you to pick up the cold water pipe somewhere else in the house. It has to be right at the point of entrance. And number two, if the meter is in the house, I know Nassau County requires it, but even in Suffolk, it's a good practice if you have a good electrician when he does a service change, they'll put the same size conductor as required by NEC around the meter just as part of the service change. It's two clamps and about 3 feet of wire. It's no big deal. But it's a good practice to do it. Like I said, it is required in Nassau. KD2HEC, back to net.
I thank you for that additional information, Steve. And yes, I think whenever I've looked at the actual circuitry inside of a GFCI, there is a transformer-like device looking for a thorough balance of current between the neutral lead and the hot lead. In other words, if the hot lead is drawing 10 amperes, that better be exactly 10 amperes flowing back from the neutral lead within a few milliamperes. Any imbalance between those two currents of more than a few milliamps will trip the GFI. So it is only sensing outgoing and incoming current on neutral and hot. and is, I think in most of them, is not sensing any current flowing on the green ground lead, the earthing lead. It doesn't sense that current on most designs, is my belief. Let's see if anybody has any further comments on that one. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KD2HUC.
Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, typically what they do, Dick, is both conductors, and this works for three-phase ground fault devices also. What they do is just either the hot in the neutral or all three phases in the neutral, they all run through one current transformer. And the current transformer ends up picking up the net difference. So they don't actually have to detect what's flowing in each wire. They just pass both of them through the CT, and whatever net imbalance there is outputted by the CT to the electronics, and when it hits the threshold, it trips. Some of them go as actually as big as 1,200 amp. KD2HUC.
Steve, tell me about a 220 or 240 volt circuit GFI. If I've got a 240 volt socket on the outside of my house in order to run some heavy machinery, and I want to do a GFI in that particular case, one end of my 240 volts is the so-called red wire, the other end of my 240 volts is the black wire, and there's also a neutral, of course. Depending on what kind of machinery I'm running, I guess if the machinery is working correctly, red current and black current should be thoroughly balanced to each other. However, if I now decide to use that GFI circuit on a 110 volt piece of machinery, where I'm connecting the 110 volt piece of machinery between red and neutral or between black and neutral, I've now created a huge imbalance. So can there be a GFI? And maybe I think what the answer might be that if I insist on having a 240 volt circuit on the outside of my house, I connect nothing but 240 volt load to it, and I must have a thoroughly separate circuit for the 120 volts. Give me some words on this one, Steve. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
To quote one of my favorite engineers, you're using good common sense, but that's not the way it works. Like I said, all the current carrying conductors, the hots, the neutrals, they all go through a single CT. It doesn't matter how much current is on each of those wires, as long as the net yield from all the magnetic field from all three of those wires, as long as the net field is zero, then the GFI doesn't trip. And yes, they made two-fold GFIs that do exactly that. It has a CT around both A, B, and the neutral, and the CT measures the exact, the net difference between them. It'd be the same as putting an amp probe around the actual power cable with both conductors. No matter how much current you draw, the amp probe would always show zero because the fields cancel out. KD2HUC, back to net.
Okay, more good information. Thank you, Steve. If I'm now running a three-phase machine, no private house per se has three-phase wiring. So this is an industrial environment. So I got a three-phase machine running on three-phase power. Is there any kind of a use of the machine by which one of the phases has more current drain than the other two? And should we be able to sense that as a fault? So tell me about the GFI-like sensing on three-phase power. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right. In industrial environments, actually, starting with the main, services of 1,200 amp or better are supposed to have GFI protection on them that actually trips the main breaker. But we're not talking for equipment protection. We're not talking for personnel protection now. We're talking about premises wiring protection. But basically, it's the same concept. You have all three conductors, all three phases, and the neutral going through a single CT. It doesn't matter what the combination, you might have 10 amps on phase A, 3 on B, and so on and so forth. As long as whatever's going out on one at any instant of time is coming back on any combination of the others, you're okay. The net balance is zero, and therefore you don't trip the GFI. So it doesn't really matter how balanced the load is. What the GFI is sensing is the net imbalance, which means you have current that's not accounted for. You have all three phases in the neutral going to a CT. If it's not accounted for, that means it's taking some, we'll call it an unauthorized path back to the source, and it's considered a ground fault. KD2HEC, back to net.
You've used the word CT quite often. I presume that stands for current sensing transformer. Is that true, Steve?
Yes, CT, current transformer.
Okay, here's a case where if my house was real super safety wired with GFI-like devices, and my dryer, I have an electric dryer, the main heating element of the dryer runs on 220, which means it's going from red to black wire. That's the heating element. The motor that runs the dryer is running on 120, so it's going from red to neutral. Therefore, by definition, my electric dryer creates an unbalanced looking load. Would that false alarm, a GFI, connected to my dryer? KD2HUC, K2IW in the TechNet.
No, it wouldn't, because you're confusing ground fault and imbalance. Imbalance means all phases carry the same amount of current. That's a different protection. They use that on transformers, switchgear buses, stuff like that, where a straight three-phase load, where all phases should be equal. And if they're not equal, that means that there could be a problem. Let me let it drop. Ground fault protection is not searching for an imbalance. It's looking for unaccounted for current, okay? When you hook up a ground fault circuit interrupter, okay, all of the correct paths for the current flow through that device. If it's a 220 volt, it would be a neutral, it would be both phases and a neutral. If it's 110 volt, it's the phase and the neutral. All of the appropriate current paths go through that device so that it can look for the net difference between what's going out on one and what's coming back on the other at any point in time. It's only when there's unaccounted for current where it could trip the GFI. Now, with your dryer example, let me let it drop. Years ago, you were allowed to use the neutral as your equipment ground on a dryer. You didn't actually have to run a separate bonding conductor. So now, typically your dryer would be next to your washer, which would have be connected to plumbing and so forth with the stainless steel hoses and all that other good stuff. And they had special bonding for that. If your dryer was touching your washing machine and now you had power going out on one phase, going through the motor to neutral, and some of that current just happened to be going through the chassis to the washing machine, well, that current is now not coming back on the dryer circuit. It's taking a different path to ground and would now be unaccounted for current. And that would trip the GFI. Does that make sense to you? KD2HEC, back connect.
Yes, it does. So in my particular case, red and black has got the 220 volt heating element. Let's say the red goes to the motor and the other end of the motor goes to neutral. But when I look at all three leads, red, black, and neutral, they are balanced. There's no other extraneous, mysterious current flowing from that circuit. So that although the red and black are unbalanced because the dryer motor on one of them, still it's accounted for by what's going on with the neutral. So a properly wired GFI to my dryer would not trip as long as the voltage drop on the neutral was not finding a mysterious current path by way of the two chassis, the dryer and the washing machine touching each other, and now I might create a trip. And so although there could be a potential difference between the chassis of the dryer and the chassis of the washing machine, hopefully the voltage drop across that neutral is only a fraction of a volt, and it's not a big enough voltage to create a risk, even though it would cause an alarm of the GFI on the dryer. Do I have that correct, Steve? KD2HUC, K2IW in the TechNet.
Yep, 100% correct. And as you pointed out, the potential difference between chassis, you know, typically when you're moving laundry from one machine to the other, your hands get wet. So I guess probably sometime after, you know, people might have been feeling a little tingle between the two machines, they changed the code, and now you're required to run a four-wire circuit to a dryer with a separate equipment ground, and the neutral has to remain isolated. KD2HUC, back to net.
Okay, so the dryer is a four-wire circuit. I presume the washing machine is still a three-wire circuit because it's running on 120. Is that true, Steve? In other words, the modern-day washing machine, it's three-wire, is what I think we're saying. Over to you, Steve.
Yeah, the washing machine, you know, just plugs into a standard 120-volt receptacle, and it should, of course, be grounded. It was probably up until, I want to say, about the 90s, where there was a real copper bracket that would connect from the neutral to the chassis of the machine. And you only had to run three wires for a dryer circuit, two hots and a neutral, and the neutral doubled as the ground. I want to say, going back somewhere around the 90s, that and now you had to include a separate bonding conductor as part of that. And of course, the same thing with ranges, too. They require now a four wire instead of a three wire. Same concept. KD2HUC, back to that.
While we are on the subject of wiring and mysterious currents flowing through grounding and copper pipes and whatever, in my 1957 house, in the first few years I lived here, there is a copper pipe near the hot water heater that developed pinholes. And I didn't know what the pinholes were being caused by, so I would go through the process of soldering up the pinhole, and more of them kept coming. I also noticed that every 10 or 12 or 15 years, I had to replace the hot water heater because it rusted out. Well, the hot water heater is supposed to be, oil-fired hot water heater, and it's supposed to be glass-lined. Therefore, the water, in theory, should not be touching any of the metal, if you know what I mean. Let me drop it. I came to the conclusion that some mysterious galvanic action was going on in my copper pipe with my hot water heater and the rest of the house. And on a lark, I guess it was around 18 years ago, I decided to isolate the hot water heater itself. The input cold line and the output hot line on the hot water heater, I put an insulated junction on those. So my hot water heater, the tank of the hot water heater is floating, and where the oil-fired furnace itself goes into it, I made sure that was isolated with the rubber washers. So now because you have to make sure that the oil burner is grounded, but I wanted it to be thoroughly floating compared to the hot water heater tank. The pinholes in the copper pipe have never happened again in the next 18 years. And when I now take apart the sacrificial rod on the center of my hot water heater and look at it, it looks like the day it was made. My hot water heater is 18 years old, and the sacrificial rod hasn't been touched. There's a huge advantage I see of floating your hot water heater tank. Lots of people are reporting, lots of people are replacing the hot water heater every 15 years or so. They're putting a moat around it. They're putting fancy water detecting circuits so that they know if a leakage occurs, they set off an alarm. And so they're correcting the problem too far downrange. I see a huge advantage in floating the tank of a hot water heater. I seem to be a rare person doing that. I wonder if you guys who've talked to some really smart people, are other people doing that? And I guess there's a little bit of a danger in it, though I'm not quite sure what it is. I guess if I wanted to be super safe, I would put a 10 kilo-ohm resistor between my hot water heater tank and the rest of the plumbing just to make sure that a static charge is not built up in there. But I think an awful lot of the failure of a hot water heater is galvanic action as opposed to pure rusting of water-touching steel, if you know what I mean. Anybody with any further comments, please give me your call letters and name right now, K2RIW and the TechNet.
EC2WGB with a question. QC with a comment.
Okay, Steve and, John and Steve in that order. Go ahead, John.
Very good, Dick. But don't forget, you have
BX cable running over to your hot water heater or, you know, grounded Romex or something. So I don't think you have the isolation you believe from ground. But evidently it's not causing a problem.
The BX cable going to the furnace itself that's doing the firing. That furnace is mounted going through a hole where it directs its flame into the bottom of the tank of the hot water heater. That, I'm calling it furnace, what's the better word for it, but you know what I mean. The call-in device is, the way it is mounted, it's mounted on insulated shafts and rubber washers. It is floating compared to the tank. If I put an ohmmeter between my tank and the rest of the ground or copper wiring of the house, I will measure essentially an open circuit, except for the resistivity of the water. So, in my opinion, my hot water tank is completely floating from its furnace and from the copper wiring for the cold input and the hot output. Does that make some sense, John? KC2WTB, K2IW, the TechNet.
Absolutely, Dick. Sounds like you got that fixed. So the burner unit itself is isolated from the frame and the cylinder of the hot water heater mounted in some way. So, yeah, sounds like you got that fixed. Back to you, Dick.
Now, everybody has to replace their hot water heater in roughly 10 or 15 years. Mine's 18 years old, and as I said, the sacrificial rod, the magnesium rod, when I looked at it, I went and bought a brand new magnesium rod thinking I had to replace it. When I took a look at the old one, it looked like the day it was new, whereas the previous magnesium rods on the previous hot water heaters that failed, of course, it was all eaten up. And by the way, loosening up that particular nut is also a big problem unless you got a real Stucci impact wrench, because they don't put any Teflon tape in there because it has to be grounded. But it looks to me like there's a huge advantage in isolating the hot water tank. And I think very few people are doing that, and therefore the galvanic action between the water, the copper, and the steel in the tank creates galvanic action that's eating up tanks, and everybody's replacing the tank, and they think that that's got to be done, that there's no other way. I'm amazed that this seems to be a well-kept secret. I hope there's no other disadvantage. Now, I do have a slight disadvantage in that the cold water pipe and the hot water pipe coming back out are isolated from each other. And if the grounding of my house was in the wrong place, that could create a problem. Hopefully my grounding is not across that junction, if you know what I mean. KD2HUC, I know you want to add some comments. K2LIW, Steve.
Yeah, a couple of things. One, when it comes to the nut for the magnesium anode, a little copper-based never-seize is probably your best bet. It'll actually keep it from oxidizing together, and of course, because it's copper-based, conductivity is not an issue. So what I did want to ask you, Dick, is what about the aquastat? The aquastat that's mounted on the tank, I'm assuming it's line voltage, which means it should be grounded. Are you saying the aquastat on the tank is not grounded? Back to you.
That's a darn good question. Let me think about that. The aquastat is measuring water temperature by way of, and that in turn goes into a device. Let me think now. Does my aquastat have a piece of BX cable going to it? I think it does. Huh. I'm going to have to double check that. I'd like to believe that by whatever means, that thing is floating with a high enough resistance that it's not completing the galvanic action. Your galvanic action probably is only millivolts. And those millivolts between the extremely low impedance of copper pipe, 3/4 inch copper pipe, and the lots of square feet of tank, the water tank itself, all kinds of millivolts can give you lots of current of galvanic action. My aquastat, maybe it has a fraction of an ohm to its ground that goes all the way back to who knows where. We think now. Not quite sure where that goes. That's probably BX wiring, and I've got to check with that BX. Is it grounding that? I'm going to have to look into that. How in the world have I gotten away with that one is what you're asking, Steve. It's a darn good question. Back to you for any further comments. Does anybody make a floating aquastat? Over to you, Steve.
I'll tell you the truth, Dick. I doubt very highly that the electrical was the issue. There might have been some dissimilar metals in the piping system. That's typically what causes it. The dielectric fittings you're talking about, they usually use them on gas water heaters. Then the copper pipe going into the ground, and it creates, the half cell. I can't think of the name of it. But anyway, that's the source of the corrosion. Isolating it will save you a lot of grief. The only thing that is a good practice when you do use the dielectric unions, I like to do it, is take a foot and a half, 2 feet of number four wire, and throw two pipe clamps, one on the hot, one on the cold, and just bond the two together right above the water heater. Those two things seem one to prevent flashover of the dielectric unions if you do have a ground fault in that. And two, just, if there is anything inadvertently connected to a hot water pipe, it's grounded. You don't want any floating pipes, if you know what I mean. KD2HUC, back to net.
Those couplers for the gas are cathodic protection.
Now, Steve, when you recommended putting a bonded wire across the cold input and the hot output copper pipe to make sure that they are electrically identical, the fact that you're mentioning that suggests that other people have isolated a water tank. So maybe I'm not as rare as I thought. So is it common practice to put that bonding wire that you're now describing across an isolated water tank? That's question number one. And question number two, insulated coupling for the cold input and the hot output, is that a standard plumbing device, and what's it called? I used a PVC fitting, which I probably is not to code, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Steve, K2LIW.
Yeah, there are standard parts. They're called dielectric unions, and, they're typically installed right at the top of hot water heaters. Some of them even come with them. Like I said, it's not usually common so much with oil. It's more gas because of the steel gas line. But, as far as I'm concerned, from a grounding perspective, especially in a house, where I'm sure you use pipes for grounds and whatnot, I don't like to leave anything floating. Once you put these dielectric unions in there, now the hot water system is floating. I like to make sure that the whole piping system is bonded. So, and what does it cost? It's probably, at the end of the day, it's probably $15 worth of parts. Two pipe clamps, foot and a half of number four, and you're golden. Put them about 6 inches above the water heater, above the dielectric unions. No problem. KD2HUC, back to net.
I have the impression from what you're saying, Steve, that all good installations of a gas-fired hot water heater have dielectric unions for the cold in and the hot out. And I guess you're saying that you think it's rare for an oil-fired one to have that. Give me some guesses from your experience. What percentage of the gas-fired hot water heaters have dielectric unions? What percentage do you think of the oil-fired hot water heaters have dielectric unions? Over to you, Steve, K2LIW and the TechNet.
I don't think I can give you any real meaningful percentages. All I can say is that every gas-fired one I've ever put in has had them, and I've never seen an oil one with them. Which leads me to my next question. Where's your oil tank? Is it in the basement or is it in the ground?
My oil tank is in the basement, at the other end of the basement, 30 feet away. And therefore, I've got to do some heroic things periodically to make sure that very long line, buried under the concrete of the basement floor, between the oil tank and the oil-fired furnace, to make sure that line stays clean. I'm using the blue fluid poured into the... a pint of it, no, it's not a pint, maybe it's a half pint, 6 ounces, something like that. I pour it in every time I get an oil delivery. But my oil tank is in the basement, therefore it appears to be electronically floating, with the exception of this 30 feet of copper pipe that's in the concrete of the floor of the basement. Crazy installation. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the tech net.
Yeah, I wouldn't, you know, from what you're describing, it doesn't seem to me that you should have an electrolysis issue. But, who knows? You know, see some crazy things. So, but definitely, you know, if you are seeing the issue, you know, what you did floating the tank is the way to go. Like I said, just a safety sake, I like keeping the pipes at the same potential. Other than that, you know, you shouldn't have any problems.
Okay, thank you for all your information. Eric, KE2EJ, are you still there? There's a quick question I've got for you. Eric, KE2EJ, are you still there? I got a quick question for you, Eric.
Yeah, I'm here, Nick.
Thursday night, I brought to your attention the failure of a piece of electronics. I wonder, were you able to fix that by remote control, or did you have to go to the site to repair that piece of electronics? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Now, the problem that occurred because of the carriers of internet traffic. In essence, the data path from New York to here, and from here to the transmitter went down. There is a second path, except that because the internet went down, we couldn't change it. So, but there is a secondary system that took a little while to get into, and actually a bunch of people got involved in this. It was not only me, it was two other folks in remote locations, so we eventually got it straightened out.
Out of curiosity, was I the first person that informed you, and did that start the repair action, or was the repair action already in process when I informed you? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's already in process, because it actually, I think it was about, when you finally reached me, it was about 15 minutes into it already.
That's correct. Let me think now. I think it was 11:40, and I got to you around midnight, or maybe it was 1:40, and it was 2 o'clock, in that order. Okay. Let's see if Rich has any further questions or comments. Look what you got us into tonight, Rich. WB2GXM. And bring back more information when you make your measurements and you get the results. WB2GXM, K2RIW and a TechNet.
No, Dick, you drove me quite nearful, and I'm grateful for it. So thank you, Dick, John, Eric, Steve, Wisdom. And I have two by the ways. First, by the way, John, question is probably for me. And by the way, number two, my laptop got hit with malware today, so you guys back up your laptops and your desk drives often, every day. So to all the net, happy Mother's Day. WB2GXM, clear.
Yeah, we're hearing an awful lot of hostage hacking going on these days. And some friends of mine, 6 months or so ago, were hit with that. N2XJM, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric, I mean, N2XJM, go ahead.
I wonder how many of you use electrical heater for the hot water? And did you ever calculate how much it's going to cost you over a period of 20 years plus all of the exchange for the new one, comparing to tankless one that gives you water on demand? For me, it is a simple mathematics. You leave your house, and once you leave your house, your cost is zero. You come at 10 p.m. and your cost is zero. Or you come in a week later and your cost is zero. Versus electric one, you leave your house and you paint. And you come a week later and you still paint for keeping the water up to the temperature. Enter here.
Yeah, the way these tankless ones work, I presume there is a heater with such a large number of kilowatts of capability. It can take cold water in and heat it to the temperature you want to take a shower, for instance. And I guess it can do that. my oil-fired hot water heater, if I wanted to, I could turn it off except when I want to take a shower in a very short period of time because it has a lot of BTU output. It heats the tank up very, very rapidly. I could almost make mine as tankless, if you know what I mean, if I wanted to. However, if I had a very large house with three bathrooms and two people trying to fill the bathtub and a third person trying to take a shower and the wife doing cooking and trying to get hot water in the kitchen at the same time, I wonder if a tankless water heater could handle that. So tell me if you happen to know what's the BTU output of a tankless water heater of a normal size that you're considering, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good question. I didn't look for it. To give you an exact figure, it's a battery system, Italian system, but approved to be used in the United States. I'm going to put it this way. I have a rent-off, and many years ago I have put each of the boilers in to each one of the apartments. And this is hidden hot water. So I'm not paying for hidden hot water. And the guys have noticed for the first year is about 67%. Okay. I know it sounds insane. I know you cannot believe it. 67%. So in other words, there were electrical heaters before. I threw them out. Now between the heat and hot water as one unit, 67% per year. Isn't it something? Enter it here.
Yeah, there's more variables here than first meets the eye. When it comes to comparing gas versus oil, the BTUs you get per dollar, I think most of the time come out fairly close. But when it comes to I2R heating, electrical heating versus the price of oil, I don't know the exact numbers, but if somebody told me that because we're paying, by the time you pay all of the fees and taxes and everything else in this area, your electrical power is costing you close to 19 cents a kilowatt hour. 19 cents a kilowatt hour, and maybe the equivalent with oil is more like 12 cents a kilowatt hour, if you know what I mean. So there's another variable involved here. Do you have any idea what your electrical power from Con Ed is costing you in cents per hour when you add up all the taxes and all the 40 other fees that are all tacked on there? N2XJN, K2RIW, the TechNet.
That is my wife's domain. Unfortunately, she's in Poland, so I cannot ask her. She's enjoying her time. But when I was talking to the technical support from Baxi, I said it must be some kind of trick here. It couldn't be this way. And the guy said to me, listen, think of it this way. You need, for this particular apartment, you need that much of the energy per unit of time to heat that much of water. And because it is instant, that means when the water flows from the bottom, you have the flame that is heating. That flame is not heating and staying. That flame is fluctuating. So for the first 3 seconds, you have a flame, and then you have a modulated flame. By that, you're already saving. Now, when you have a heating, it doesn't constantly heat. It just keep the temperature level. It's like you're trying to push your car and with few guys, and it's difficult, but when it's running, the all you need is just compensation for the losses. And that is extremely minuscule amount of energy. Let me jump. So now, coming back to my example, I'm leaving my house and I'm coming 2 weeks from now. My cost of the total cost of the energy use is zero because nothing is happening. Once I open up the valve, it is heating. It is heating only for as much as I need to take the shower. And the same with any other apartment. I don't care about how many bathrooms do I have, because this thing is good for 24,000 square meters, not square foot, 2,400 square meters of the area, one bathroom. Luna 310. It's the old unit. So, think how many apartments do you have for 2,400 meters square? Enter a cheer.
I'm confused by the units that are being combined here. 2,400 square meters of apartment area, and you're also talking about a tankless water heater that heats the water for domestic hot water, for showers, tubs, and whatever. So, how are they related? Over to you, Wes, K2LIW.
Okay. Each meter is approximately 3 feet in a meter. When you have a square meter, you have meter by meter, so you have 3 times 3, you have 9 square feet, it's 1 meter. Now, the backseat system that I have is good for heating the apartment or the house, 2,400 square meters. So that would be a huge house. Now, you worry about if this thing is able to deliver the water to 3 bathrooms. Well, it looks like it can. But I have it very much done this way, that each apartment is using for heating hot water at unit. I'm paying pennies. Actually, the tenants are paying for heating hot water and they don't complain. And I'm paying only for my apartment. So, that's what I can do. If you just Google Luna 310 FI, you're going to see and correct that information that I gave you. I just don't have a computer in front of me to compare all of that information. Enter a cheer.
I'm missing something here. By the way, a square meter is very close to 10 square feet because a meter is 3.28 feet per meter. I think you're describing a tankless hot water heater used for heating the water for baseboard radiation heating to heat a room. That's the only way I can see that the domestic hot water heating and square feet of room can be related. So are you using a tankless hot water heater to heat the water that goes into the baseboard radiation of a hot water feed? Is that what you're describing, Wes? N2XJN?
K2CX with some info.
K2CX, pick up. Yes, in other words, yes, if you measure the size of the room, that's European way of measuring how much do you need to heat the space. Usually, the space is 4, 4.5 meters tall, high. So now all you need is just XY for the dimension, and you have easy way to calculate it. But 2,400 feet is a huge house. I mean, 2,400 square meters. Yes, you're right. 3 feet by 3 feet is one square meter. So 3 by 3 is 9. Now, close to 10. Enter a cheer.
Steve, K2CX, wait for the beep and give us your information.
Yeah, these what number did you say?
The old system is Luna 310, but that's the old system. I have it works like a horse with no problem. They have three or four different new models right now.
Yeah, but these are not electric. They're gas. These are modulated, domestic and heating, with domestic flow rates of 3.3 gallons at 77 degrees Fahrenheit rise, ICF rise. So these are direct vent gas machines, right?
Correct. It's a gas machine, so it doesn't use electric.
There's the answer.
And use only on demand.
Yeah, there's the confusing. The way you described it, it was as if the sole source of power to make the heating and the hot water was going to be solely electric. The electric is for control purposes only. I did a lot of investigating into these units myself, when I changed my boiler out in the house, I was considering doing this, but I didn't go around, I didn't go through it because of the fact that I had to get gas in the house, and I just didn't want to deal with it all, so I changed similar equipment out. But in any case, there you go, Dick, a little better understanding now.
But you have, for the stove, you have also a gas. So, what's the difference? The only thing is that you don't use your electric. Most of you guys are just paying for heating your water and keeping the temperature, even though that you don't need it. And that's a big, big deal. Interesting.
Steve, are you saying that your house is oil-fired? You didn't bring gas?
Repeater, time out.
You didn't bring gas into your house. Your house is oil-fired for both hot water and heating for the domestic air. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, that's correct. And to further complicate it, they have to extend the street main about somewhere in the vicinity of 100 feet, which I have to pick up part of that expense. Somewhere in the vicinity of $1,800 to have them supply. I think they put a 4-inch plastic main in the street. The piece of pipe from the street to my house is no charge. So there were a number of other issues. And the house is small enough, and I basically heat and make hot water for my house with less than 500 gallons of oil a year.
That's close to the number of gallons that I'm burning. I presume you, for a short period of time, considered electric heating, and my guess is you rapidly came to the conclusion that that would be pretty expensive. Is that true, Steve?
Yeah, my feelings regarding electric heating here on Long Island with the power company here and a number of other issues is you're better off taking $1 bills and the amount of money you'd be spending for electricity and spooling them up real tight and burning them to make your heat and hot water. You'd get more money out of burning the dollars than using electric.
I know that's an exaggeration, but oil with 120 or 130,000 BTUs per gallon is a very dense fuel. To operate a vehicle with oil is a very reasonable thing to do. To operate heating of houses and factories with oil, as opposed to some of the solar voltaics and some of the renewables, that's a whole other thing to consider. Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Rich one more time. If you got any, Rich already had his final comments. I think it's time we go over to the mailbag, which we haven't had for a while. So give us a nice go ahead, Eric.
Did you get my email that I sent you?
I've got lots of emails from you. Tell me the subject matter.
I sent you one on the current state of tunas, and then I sent you another one. Now I can't remember. I'm sorry. Give me a second. I'll look it up.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, but I can't remember it. We'll eventually figure out which one it was, but yes, I've gotten some pretty massive emails from you in the last week or so.
I thought you would find, what were we talking about? Now I remember. The one about the fuel for the RTV.
Tell me what RTV stands for. Remote temperature vehicle.
Sorry, RPG. The radioactive generator.
Yes, now remember. The fact that Tennessee is now coming online and going to start be making plutonium-238 in order to make these radioactive thermal generators for the space probes. And the rate at which they're going to be making it is seemingly very slow. And I have the impression that the fuel they recover from the weapons that are being disassembled is plutonium-239, and the RTGs use plutonium-238. A little bit confused as to why you can use one and not the other. And
It's too bad there isn't some way of taking 239 and converting it to 238. Obviously there isn't, or no simple way. But I hope they find a faster way, because the article led me to believe that they're going back into production, but the rate at which they're going to be getting it is going to be kind of slow. And therefore, there's going to be a number of NASA spacecraft that are going to be hurting for fuel, so to speak. KE2EJ, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Dick, I believe they said they won't be up to speed for 12 years. Is that correct?
Eric's going to correct all of that after he waits for the beams. And Eric, try not to beep, try not to turn it out. Time out.
All right, let's see. I believe 239 is too reactive and the K-rate is too bad, if I remember correctly. But the country currently has 35 kilograms of the stuff left, and that's already spoken for. Curiosity used 10 pounds, 4.8 kilograms of 238, and Oak Ridge is, they actually just fired up another mothballed reactor to try and produce more of it. And the 238 from Oak Ridge gets stuff to make it from Idaho National Laboratory, and then in the end they expect to be able to make lots of it. But 238 is not manufactured because it isn't used in weapons.
If the 239 can't be used because it degrades too rapidly, and 239 is what's part of the core of a weapon system, does that mean that my weapon system has to be serviced every couple of years? If so, that could be a real pain. Over to you, Eric, K2LAW.
I don't have the answer to that. But I can find out. Let's see. There's a thing in this thing that I sent you. It says, at the time, it wasn't important to them to manufacture 238 because it was a small part of the mission to produce plutonium for weapons.
So when they're making 239 for weapons, the 238 was one of the side products, one of the fallout products they got, and all of a sudden somebody found a much better use for it because it's got a huge half-life. Over to you, Eric.
I can't really answer that. Let me see what they say. Production of 238 is complicated. The Oakwood team starts with radioactive neptunium-237 from Idaho National Laboratories, another DOE facility. The engineers then process the neptunium into targets which are blasted with beams of neutrons in one of two reactors at Oakwood. This creates the plutonium-238, which is then chemically processed and shipped to a third DOE site in Los Alamos. Then, they further process the stuff encapsulating pellets, and that gets shipped to an INL for integration into the radioactive generator. Power systems are tested in Ohio, in the Idaho site, and if all goes well, then it's shipped to NASA's Kennedy Space Center and prepped for launch. Where did I drop? The restart of plutonium-238 production hasn't made it to the latter few steps, however. Oak Ridge is still figuring out the best way to manufacture and process the plutonium. The team can't simply copy what was done at Savannah River during the Cold War because the facilities involved are quite different. For example, the nuclear reactors at Oak Ridge available are quite small and as wide as a 55-gallon drum. Use of Savannah is not an option. The Savannah reactors that once produced 238 have been shut down. And then they go on to say that the restart team is trying out new processing techniques, ones that relies on solvent extraction as opposed to exchange columns. And blah, 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 blah. But you can see it's, okay. The wheels of plutonium-238 restarted turning. Oak Ridge made some plutonium. After all, the lab shipped two small samples, a half an ounce, or 0.2 of an ounce, or 5 grams each, to Los Alamos earlier this year. So you can see it's a real slow process. And they finish off by saying it takes considerable time and effort to validate the processes involved, get fully up to speed. The team is currently at testing a way to increase yields and reduce the number of Neptunium-237 targets needed. K2RIW, K2 again.
WS21. Paul recognized one of those articles also talked about the fact that the radioactive thermal generator in an electrical power output runs at something like 8% efficiency.